Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Open Floor Podcast by Sports Illustrated. I'm Ben Golliver. Joining me today in place of Andrew Sharp is Rob Mahoney. Now, Rob, you're here in Oklahoma City with me, which means you were in the building for the infamous kick to the groin by Draymond Green to Steven Adams. We've been waiting with bated breath all day long for the announcement of what will happen to Draymond Green and his availability in Game 4. And it's just coming down now. Multiple reports say that he will not be suspended for Game 4. Instead, basically, they will upgrade the flagrant foul, one that was given to him upon a video review during the game. They will upgrade that to a flagrant foul 2. And they will assess a $25,000 fine on top of that. But again, Draymond Green is not going to be suspended. So clearly, the Warriors are breathing a gigantic sigh of relief. I think the number one question to talk about here, obviously, is did the NBA league office get it right? What do you think?
I think they did. And some of that has to do with, you know, the precedent matters, the established track record of these kinds of incidents matter. But also, you don't want to deprive the playoff field. You don't want to deprive these teams. You don't want to deprive your audience of the best basketball possible. And I think when you allow punitive measures to get in the way of that, as the NBA has done in some occasions in the past, I think perhaps wrongly, you're really working against yourself and your game. And so in this case, Draymond Green gets an extra flagrant point more than he was assessed initially. He gets a $25,000 fine, but you're still getting the best of both of these teams, which is, I think, what really matters most.
Yeah, so I think it's a really interesting case study between the David Stern era and the Adam Silver era, right? David Stern seemed to really have that punitive side to him. Like, he almost was gleeful when he got to punish people. And Adam Silver doesn't really seem to have that. I think if there's a word that would be used to describe his overall tenure, I would say it would probably be pragmatic, right? Like, he's always looking for consensus solutions that kind of make everybody happy. And I think, obviously, this was a case where there was, like, two pretty polar choices, right? Suspension, non-suspension. And yet what they ended up coming up with was pretty much the closest thing you could get to a compromise, right? And I think it really benefited pretty much everybody aside from the Thunder, of course. I think it benefits the league office because they're not a headline, right? Like, this is not NBA steps in and screws over the Western Conference Finals by heavy-handedness. So they avoid that. They also make it about basketball, like you mentioned. I think the Warriors obviously win because they get a top 10 player to be on the court in the most important game of the season. So no question about it, they win. I think Draymond really wins here too, individually. I think he's been a very good citizen for the NBA in terms of his community service work, money that he's donated. Yes, he's obviously very fiery, volatile. That can definitely get the best of him. And I think he's certainly developing a reputation among his peers with some of these plays. But his explanation that it wasn't intentional to me was fairly believable. I was willing to give him something of a pass. I didn't think it was an automatic ejection during the game, and I certainly didn't think it was an automatic suspension. So they win. And then also, I think the Thunder, at least they go home with a parting favor, right? Like, the fine and the upgraded flagrant, it's not maybe the best case scenario for them, but it's better than nothing. And then, of course, I think the basketball audience, and let's not forget the television partners, they obviously win here too, right? Because the ratings are going to be gigantic for Game 4. And I think if you want to see the best players on the court and you want to see this series at its best, that's got to involve, Draymond Green being on the court. So to me, I thought it was kind of a pragmatic solution from a pretty pragmatic commissioner.
No, I tend to agree. I mean, the critical thing is, especially at this point of the series, you want to try to divorce yourself from the context as much as you can if you're trying to make a fair decision and a just decision. But I think, and Ethan Strauss with ESPN.com laid out a really good column kind of detailing the fact that this, justice is kind of a weird mechanism when you're talking about an entertainment industry, when you're talking about, a game that does need to be officiated fairly and adjudicated fairly. But it's not like we're talking about Supreme Court precedent here. It's not like we're talking about anything of any kind of grander consequence in that regard. What matters, I think, most you know, and maybe this is just me speaking from my own personal perspective in terms of wanting to see both of these teams, you know, at their maximum potential. I want to see the Warriors, who have been the best problem solving team in the league, really get a crack of at you know, figuring out what the Thunder did to them in game three. How do they address that? How do they, you know, challenge it? How are they able to tweak their rotations and their lineups to put a better product out there? And when you take Draymond Green out of that equation, it really does hurt it a lot. And, you know, frankly, the justice element is just kind of so divorced from the reality of this industry and this situation to me, especially when you're talking about, I know a lot of people will be upset, you know, by the fact that he wasn't suspended and, you know, player X was. But ultimately, I just don't think it matters enough. And really, you're talking about, I'm sure, a certain field of fans who really just kind of want to see the Warriors get their comeuppance, who want to see Draymond, a guy who certainly, you know, conducts himself in a certain way. And, you know, by no means is he exempt from blame in this. I think he's certainly reckless, you know, in terms of with his body. I think he's certainly walked the line in terms of whether this was intentional or not. I think, as you said, it's plausible and it's believable that this was just kind of an extension of him trying to get the call and kind of flailing his whole body as a result of that. But I think it was something a little bit more than unintentional. And as you said, you know, this penalty reflects that.
For sure. And I also think, you know, let's give the Thunder credit for how they've handled this situation, because while they did kind of call out Draymond for, in some cases, his intent, you know, kind of casting aspersions on what he was trying to do, they didn't campaign necessarily directly for the suspension. And on top of that, they actually said, look, we'd like to play them with or without them. We feel like we can beat them. I mean, that was Stephen Adams' message today in between answering questions about whether he was going to have to wear a cup for game four. He put it out there. He said, look, we think that we can beat them with or without them. And that's the attitude you want to have. And I think ultimately, when you're playing with history here too, I mean, there's a 73 win season at stake. It would really be a shame to have all of that work, you know, over the last 6 months go out the window because of a debatable play in game three and then an NBA decision for game four. So, like I said, I think this is the most fair thing. So here's the real question. What do you expect from Draymond during game four?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question, especially since that may have been the worst performance of his postseason career to date. You know, he couldn't stay in front of anybody defensively. He wasn't able to finish at the rim, you know, regardless of who was contesting there. There were some shots where he had pretty much a wide open layup and just came up a little short or a little off. He had more turnovers than assists in the game. He didn't make any threes in the game. It really was just kind of a poor all around effort. And I think, you know, coming off of that kind of performance to begin with, you would expect him to be kind of fully focused and locked in. But with the way that he feeds off of an antagonistic crowd, I mean, it's going to be incredibly loud, definitely so. You know, the boos for him after this whole incident, I would expect him to kind of respond in point. I mean, he's exactly the kind of player who can grin through that and can really put up a really solid game. And I would expect him and the Warriors to both have a really, really nice game four.
Yeah. So he's had some bounce backs already in this postseason after some poor games or games where he didn't feel like he was locked in necessarily. So I think that bodes well for him. But this is also uncharted waters, both for him and I think for the Warriors. I mean, they have not faced a test like this in the postseason. We said that coming into the Western Conference Finals, that I think it's totally proven out to be true. The Thunder are definitely better than any team the Warriors faced last year, and they're light years better than the Blazers, the Rockets, you know, the Golden State's first two opponents in the playoffs. And I think on top of that, they've showed just an unbelievable mental resolve through all this crazy drama during the postseason. I mean, every single week we've been on this podcast talking about how well they've handled themselves, you know, after months of questions about how they would do in late game situations, how they would handle the pressure. And this is just another great example of it. I mean, going back to the Spurs series, they survived those two crazy, you know, foul situations late here. Adams is able to pick himself up after two straight low blows and continue to play really strong basketball. And, you know, there's no question about it. In game three, the turning point of that entire game was the kick. I mean, look at the gigantic run. I think it was 24-7 to close the half that Oklahoma City went on. You know, Steph Curry said, you know, the 6 minutes after the kick was the difference in that game because of how Oklahoma City responded and how scattered and, you know, uncohesive Golden State was. So full credit to the Thunder, not only how they handled the situation off the court, but then how they handled it on the court. And they're really putting a lot of pressure on the Warriors as a whole, but also on Draymond Green individually. And part of the problem is he's got a little Westbrook to him. And we talked about this yesterday, you and I did, Rob. You know, sometimes you wonder if Westbrook will be his own enemy by trying too hard there is some potential that that could happen for Draymond here in game four, don't you think?
I think definitely. And I completely agree in terms of, you know, all the credit that needs to be given to the Thunder in terms of how they've conducted themselves in the series and the pressure that they've applied. And had Draymond been suspended, I think you would have had some people want to apply an asterisk to the series if the Warriors ultimately were to lose it. It becomes, you know, like some series in the past in which, you know, key players have been suspended or injured. The story becomes the absence of that player rather than, if the Thunder win the series on their own terms, I think they deserve, you know, a world of credit for that, for unseating a team that's this good, for improving the way they have defensively from the beginning of the playoffs until now. It really is an incredible achievement, and I would hate to see that overshadowed by a storyline like this one. And I think the best way to kind of move on from it, to kind of sweep it under the rug a little bit, is to do what the NBA has done here, which is to kind of hit that compromise, to give him the upgraded flagrant penalty, to give him the fine, but really let the best players play and see how it works out.
Okay, so let me play devil's advocate then, because I know there's some people out there who are saying, you guys are on the take, you're too soft on the NBA's decision-making, the NBA needed to be hold a much firmer line, and then now this is going to set up a slippery slope, right? Because you've got Draymond with the one sort of pretty clearly unintentional blow to Adams earlier. Now you've got another one. You've got a whole bunch of guys who like to play physically. You've got an entire season on the line basically here in game four. The NBA has now kind of lit the fuse, and this could turn really ugly really quickly between two competitive teams. And if they had simply thrown the book at Draymond Green, it wouldn't be such a powder keg. Do you buy that line of thinking or that argument?
I don't really, and some of it is just because I think, you know, the tension in this series is already there, the physicality is already there. I mean, sure, if you take Draymond Green out of it for a game, maybe you relieve some of that just because he's one of the more physical players on the floor, and he's certainly an instigator in his own way. But it's not like when Draymond Green comes back that the Thunder aren't going to, be very aware of what he is and where he is and what he's doing in terms of, you know, this kind of flopping or this kind of intentional hitting, however you want to read the situation. I just don't see the series getting any less pressure filled than it has been, or losing any of that bite just because if he were to be suspended for a game.
If this isn't Draymond Green, a guy who's gotten a lot of positive publicity here, you know, donates $3 million to Michigan State, defensive player of the year runner up, you know, he's going to be an all NBA selection for sure. All defensive selection. He was an all-star this year. You know, we put him on the cover of Sports Illustrated this week. If this was not Draymond Green and this was instead, you know, say DeMarcus Cousins, who I saw tweeting about double standard type stuff today, or if it was a J.R. Smith, do you think the NBA would have handled this differently? Do they have a special treatment of superstar players, the kinds of guys who you're mentioning can be a central force in sort of the greater good, right? Like the kind of guy who has to be on the court for it to be an important game, or a guy who's central to the league's marketing efforts. I mean, do you feel like the NBA has a certain set of rules for those kinds of guys?
I mean, I think in some cases they do, but more often, and I think, you know, DeMarcus Cousins, I think, has a great case. I think it tends to go more the other way, where there are certain players who it seems like no matter what they do, always, you know, they never get that benefit of the doubt. And Cousins is certainly one of those guys. I don't think that Green is, you know, necessarily on the complete other end of the spectrum. I don't think he has, you know, a spotless reputation in terms of his play on the court, in terms of some of the dark arts, you know, as they say, some of the more dirty play. I think he's kind of in the mix with that kind of stuff, and the league is certainly aware of that. I don't think he's getting any extra leeway here by virtue of him being a good citizen, so much as the fact that this is a really important decision that the NBA knew it needed to get right. And they certainly took their time in terms of evaluating and announcing this decision and this information. So I would be shocked if they didn't let the fact that it is Draymond Green, that it's a player this good, weigh into that evaluation. And frankly, I think they should do that.
Do you think that this episode, or whatever you want to call it, has wake up call potential? Because I've been kind of ranting about the Warriors these last couple weeks, just kind of calling them, you know, sort of the team that, you know, wants to win with style points too much. They don't necessarily stay committed game to game on what makes them great. They try to cover up for some of their flaws or lack of effort or lack of focus with their pure talent, which is obviously evident, but sometimes not enough to kind of paint over those situations. Do you think kind of, it's almost a brush with death, really, right? Like waiting around, sitting for 24 hours, trying to find out if you're going to get to have your second most important player on the court for the biggest game of your year. Do you think that's the kind of thing that will rally them as a team mentally to kind of let them lock in for a game four? Because they're going into a really tough building. I mean, Chesapeake Energy Arena was unbelievable last night, wasn't it?
Oh, it was. No, 100%.
One of the loudest buildings I've ever heard and one of the most excited buildings. And they really went after Draymond individually for much of that game afterwards, you know, after the incident. And you know they're going to be incredibly loud for game four. They're going to be going after him during pregame warmups. I mean, all the way to the final tip, no question, or the final buzzer, no question. Do you think that there's this rallying theory or is that stuff overrated? Is it just about basketball?
No, I think there's some potential for that, but I would hope that the rallying, you know, the rally and the rallying cry has more to do with the fact that they just got ran off the floor than anything that happened with Draymond Green. I mean, this is a team that needs to respond, and I would hope that they're aware at this point that if they don't bring, you know, their best effort and their best possible game, then that's what's going to happen again. The Thunder are that explosive offensively, and they've been that precise defensively so far.
I totally agree, but why didn't that happen after game one? It's like, how many wake-up calls do you guys freaking need? Like, how close do you want to get to the fire before you realize you're getting burned? And no doubt, I mean, game three, they got absolutely incinerated. It starts with Draymond, honestly. It really is on his shoulders. I mean, that minus 43 was his career worst. He never had a worse plus-minus than minus 20. It was the worst plus minus in the playoffs since at least 1997. I mean, that was a terrible effort from him. Offensively, he couldn't make anything. Defensively, I mean, he was so lost defensively. I've never seen him that lost time and time again on the defense end of the court, just getting blown by off the dribble. You know, how often does the game look too fast for Draymond Green? Not very often. So it starts with him, I think, for sure. But also, I think, doesn't Steph need to step up a little bit here too? Or are we at the point where we need to wonder how much more can he do with his body? Because, and I think I made this comment to you earlier or somebody else earlier, I think he's looked like the MVP of the NBA in this series for one of the 12 quarters. You know, that big burst third quarter in game two, he clearly looked like the best player on the court. And the rest of the series, I would say, you know, Kevin Durant and Russell Westbrook have been basically outshining him.
Right. No, I tend to agree. And as far as the Warriors' two losses in this series, to me, they're pretty different in that the game one loss, I think, was a lot of the Warriors not quite being able to get into their stuff, really being disrupted in terms of their process, being disrupted in terms of some of the things the Thunder were doing defensively. They weren't able to get to the shots they wanted. Versus in game three, I think this might have worked to their disadvantage in a way. A lot of the looks that the Warriors were getting, especially early in the game when it was still, you know, fairly competitive or when the Thunder were first starting to pull away, were the kinds of shots you would want. I mean, Steph Curry was missing open threes. Klay Thompson missed some open shots. Guys were missing layups right at the rim. It was a lot of makeable shots that you would really expect to go down for a team that's been this good and really has had those kind of hot stretches for so long. And when those things don't happen, I think they start to drag even more. This really isn't a team that can dig in defensively to really pull itself out of those holes that often. You know, they've certainly had games where they've done that to their credit, but I don't see them being able to rely on that so much. They need to be in a flow offensively, and really they need to be in a position where, you know, a lot of their turnovers and when they're being denied at the rim by the Thunder in the series are going right the other way. You know, Kevin Durant had three blocks in game three, turned around for 7 points, you know, a three-pointer and I think two layups. And you have those situations a lot where when the offense isn't clicking, things start to fall apart for them a little bit.
Yeah, you know, coaches always want the offense to start with the defense. And I agree with you. I think the Warriors' defense starts with their offense. Like if they're making shots, that's when they ratchet up the defensive effort because they start to smell the, you know, the kill and they want to get back and play offense and take shots as quickly as possible. At times, I think especially when Steph was out earlier in the playoffs, they were able to win defense first. That kind of became their identity for stretches because it kind of had to be almost out of necessity when you take a guy who's averaging 30 points off the court. That's just sort of how it had to be. But when Steph's out there, I agree, it kind of goes the other way. And, you know, it hasn't been there. And I think that's a really dangerous approach, too, against a team that's also really potent. I mean, and we talked about that coming into the Western Conference Finals, how this was a matchup of the, you know, the top two teams, the amount of star power, the amount of scoring options on both sides. And Golden State doesn't really seem to still buy into the idea that they're playing a team that's more or less its equal, especially from an offensive standpoint. They still just kind of think that they can win any shootout. And as we saw in game three, like they got humiliated, you know, I mean, they got ran off the court, like you mentioned. And so we'll see how they respond to that. You know, if I'm Kerr, and I mentioned this even after the game one loss, like that was just an unbelievably frustrating game from a coaching standpoint. And I think he's got to be feeling the same way, not only because of the way they played in game three, but then also this whole distraction with Draymond Green. I mean, they all had to answer questions today about Draymond Green at practice. It was the only subject of really of the post-game press conference after game three, or was the main subject. You know, they're going to have shoot around. They're going to have to talk about it again. That's not what you want in the middle of the biggest test of your season. So I kind of feel for Kerr, but at the same time, I don't feel that bad for him because he's still out there playing Anderson Varejao big minutes in the playoffs. So, you know, he kind of got what he deserves. I think he made the comment that the Warriors got what they deserved in game three. It's like, I think he kind of got what he deserved too. I think it's time to tighten up that rotation a little bit, go with the guys who are your best eight and forget about everybody else. So we'll see. I mean, game four is the time to adjust for the Warriors. That's sort of what their MO has been in previous series, whether it was the Grizzlies, whether it was the Cavaliers. I mean, that's sort of when they get serious strategically, and they really need it right now.
No, they do. And I think that to their credit, in terms of the just the facilities that their roster has available, they have more options in terms of how they can move on. You know, for the Thunder played great in their small ball lineups in game three. And I'm really curious to see how that holds up, especially defensively, just because it's something that we didn't see a ton from them in the regular season in terms of even when Kevin Durant did play the occasional minutes at power forward, those weren't dominant defensive lineups like they were in this last game. And so seeing how the Warriors puzzle that out, and I think they do have some options in terms of what they're dealing with, which players they put on the floor. We even saw them kind of going to Festus Ezeli in the post against some of those lineups to try to just get it inside a little more, get some offensive rebounds coming off those misses too. And I'm just so glad that we don't have to sit here and wonder, is Anderson Varejao going to be the starter for Draymond Green in game four of this series? I'm really happy to move on and see how both these teams just adjust and really acclimate themselves tactically.
Yeah, and the other big winner, of course, is Harrison Barnes, who doesn't maybe have to start at power forward for them. And then all of a sudden, he's getting just brutalized by guys like Cantor or whoever else on the glass. And so I think he's probably breathing a huge sigh of relief with that suspension news, because he can just kind of chill in his lane and not have to worry about it. The other option would be what? Mo Spates going out there taking 15 shots if he gets big minutes. I mean, that's the kind of thing that makes your skin crawl a little bit too, I think, if you're a Warriors fan. Well, I think we pretty much covered this suspension all angles. I mean, was there anything else? I guess I forgot to ask. I mean, did you think the intent thing mattered at all? Did you think it was intentional or no?
I didn't think it was intentional so much. I kind of do buy into the idea that this is something that Draymond does in terms of flailing in this way. And it's certainly an exaggeration of the contact and him trying to sell the call and probably a little bit reckless. I do think that the NBA has to look at it. You know, the flagrant assessment, I think we allow intent to get caught up in that too much, whereas the intent really has no bearing on whether it's a flagrant one or a flagrant two at all. It really does just come down to that, whether it's unnecessary contact or unnecessary and excessive contact. I think it was unnecessary and excessive, so I think the NBA is smart to assess that flagrant two. But when you're looking at, okay, is this an unsportsmanlike play that could result in a suspension? I just didn't think it warranted that.
Yeah, no, I hear you. I mean, it's really close, though. And I do think that even Kerr said there's been a lot of flailing going on, especially recently. And that's really what has contributed, I think. His argument was that it's contributed to a lot of these below the belt shots. When you've got arms and legs going all sorts of different directions, eventually they're going to hit something private and it's not going to feel good. And you know how the NBA instituted that flopping policy? I almost think that this is a byproduct of the flopping policy, right? Like, there's certain things you can't do. You know, you can't launch yourself backwards by the flopping policy, although they'll hit you with it. You know, you can't spin and rotate and do all those crazy things. But flailing is like basically like running up against the line of what's okay by that flopping policy. And so I think actually the NBA's kind of like made its bed and now it's laying on it. And I wonder if they need to have another policy like similar to the flopping policy that's like the anti-flail policy, where, you know, if the referee or video replay deems that you're, you know, just throwing your arms and legs out in a completely ridiculous way, then, you know, you're potentially subjected to a fine or a warning, sort of like the flops, to maybe cut down on some of this stuff. I know they have the leg kick offensive foul, like that's already a thing, and that's a really good rule, I think. It doesn't get enforced that often, but it's almost like they need another step here to cover some of these behaviors, because there's nothing basketball about kicking your leg out in that situation the way he did.
No, and it's tough because you want there to be that kind of process live and in game where refs have the freedom to evaluate what is or isn't a flop, but doing so just kind of puts them more and more at the replay, you know, monitor, and is taking more time out of the game, really denying the flow of the game. And you don't want to decentralize that power too much in terms of the, you know, the replay facilities and, you know, the kind of the extended officials over there and giving them too much authority to officiate what's going on in the game on a play-by-play basis, saying, okay, going back to this play in the second quarter, this guy flopped a little too much, let's issue him a warning. And so then, you know, you really do get to the state where you really have to do all these things retroactively, where you're hitting guys with warnings and fines after the fact that really isn't influencing the game that much. And I do think that puts us in that, you know, as you're saying, this kind of weird place we are now where guys are encouraged to flop to a point in particular ways because they're not going to get slapped with a fine or a warning for that specific kind of flopping. But I don't know what the right answer is.
Okay, I thought of one last question that we can end on. Does this episode change how you view Draymond Green as a player, as a person, as a man, or however you want to phrase it? I mean, everything that happened over the last 24 hours, from the kick to, you know, his explanation to the fallout to his day after explanation to what Westbrook said about him, basically saying it was intentional, and kind of calling him out a little bit. I mean, how often do you hear all-stars going at each other like that? Not very often. Does this whole episode change your opinion of him? And do you think it's going to stick with him, like, as a, you know, part of his reputation going forward, you know, into next year and beyond?
I think it'll probably stick with him just because of the magnitude of the moment. And, you know, this whole process in terms of how consequential this could have been, I think will kind of follow him a little bit around, just because he could have ultimately, you know, whatever you may think of Draymond, his actions could have cost his team this series if he were to be suspended a game four. I don't really see it as kind of cutting to the heart of the man in any particular way. You know, Draymond Green is who he is. I don't think this is insightful to his character in any particular regard. He plays really hard. Sometimes he can be a little careless with his body or overly physical, and that is kind of part of the package with him. Along with some of the kind of over-the-top competitiveness in terms of how he responds to his coaches or his teammates or his opponents or whoever on the floor. I mean, that guy wants every play so bad. And sometimes that results in some things that aren't necessarily favorable. I don't really see my opinion of him changing or shaping in any way based on this. But I mean, it's a long series. I guess there's always something, you know, if he ends up kicking Steven Adams a couple more times, maybe it does.
Yeah, and now he's closer to a potential suspension just because of his flagrant foul points. So he's not out of the woods by any stretch. And if it goes seven, you know, the possibility of something else happening here is pretty high just from, you know, the level of physicality and how competitive this series has been and how many guys you have flying above the rim, where if you're a defensive player, you take a guy out of the air because you're trying to challenge a shot that can wind up being a flagrant. So no question, I think he's, you know, he's got to be careful. And we don't really know if he's capable of being careful in that way, do we? And I think, you know, from my standpoint, it doesn't necessarily change what I think about him. I think he's still right at the top of the list of guys who you want to have on your team as teammates and you don't want to have to go against, which is always a really good category to be in. And that's kind of always one of the easiest way to judge, right? Like, would you want to have him if you're playing 2-on-2, 3-on-3, 5-on-5, or in the NBA finals? Like, the answer is always yes. You always want him on your team. Would you want to have to go against him? And no way. I mean, it'd be a nightmare. But I do think, you know, there's something to his role in this whole idea of the Warriors playing with fire. Is, you know, he's doing it too. And like you said, I mean, he went up right close to the line of putting their entire season at jeopardy with the situation, whether or not it was intentional or not. You know, he did kick his leg out. You know, he did put himself in that situation. And so he's got to answer to his teammates for that. He's got to answer to his coaching staff for that. And he's got to answer to himself for that. So that's why it makes him so fascinating for game four. Does he come out with sort of a career night? Anything short of that will almost be disappointing. And if he's bad again, that will, I think, ultimately really change how I look at him, because a big part of his reputation in my eyes is the ability to bounce back from adversity, to be really strong and reliable when you need him. And the Warriors really, really need him at this point. All right, let's wrap it up there, Rob. Thanks for hopping on the Open Floor podcast. Everybody, if you want to subscribe, iTunes, Stitcher, I think, a few other places. I'm not really an expert. Our producer, Alan Kim, can probably fill you in on those details. But from Oklahoma City, this is Ben Golliver with Rob Mahoney for Sports Illustrated. And we'll catch you later this week, back to regularly scheduled programming, with me and Andrew Sharp talking about all my ridiculous adventures here in Oklahoma City, and also probably some other lottery talk.
Thanks for tuning in for another episode of Open Floor. Please subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, or your podcast app of choice. And you can hear the whole SI network at si.com/podcasts.
Another great edition of Open Floor is in the books. Did you know Locked On has a daily podcast for all 30 NBA teams? If you're a Lakers fan, search Locked On Lakers. A Celtics fan, search Locked On Celtics. Warriors fans, search Locked On Warriors. Yes, all 30 NBA teams have a daily bite-sized podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team.
It's the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.